Welcome, and thank you for standing by. I'd like to remind participants that today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. You may begin.
Thank you very much, and welcome to everyone to our Tuesday, the 7th of September, Community Working Group for Recommendation 6 for new GTLDs. And I would like to ask Lynn to do a quick summary of the people who are on the call.
Thank you, Chuck. I will do that. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. On the call, we have Evan Lebovich, who is ALAC, Bacon de la Chapelle, GAC, French representative, John Nevitt, Commercial and Business Users Constituency, Richard Tindall, individual, Lian Wong from GAC, China, Krista Papak, Registrar Stakeholder Group, Mark Carvel, United Kingdom, GAC, Robin Gross, Non-Commercial Stakeholder Group, Steve Pinkos, individual, Liz Gaster, staff, Alan Greenberg, ALAC, Konstantinos Komatis, Non-Commercial Stakeholder Group, Jason Frakes, individual, Charles Gomes, GNSO chair and co-chair of this group, Frank Marsh, New Zealand GAC representative, Stuart Lawley, individual, and Siva Subramanian, ALAC, Cheryl Langdonor, ALAC chair, and we have our guest speaker, Carol Dorgan. As well as for staff, we have Amy Statos, David Olive, Liz Gaster, Dan Halloran, Marika Koenix, Margie Milam, and and myself, Linda Saint-Jerry. And we have just had joining the call Marilyn Cade, who is chair of the business constituency, Olivier Crépin-Leblanc, who is ALAC, and Mary Wong, who is the non-commercial stakeholder group representative on the council. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, Glenn, and I see your hand, Amy. I'll call you in just a second. I want to remind everybody that most everybody participating in this group is participating in their individual capacity. So unless they say differently, assume that they're not necessarily representing the groups or a group or groups that they're a part of. Amy.
Yeah, hi, Chuck. Thanks. I just wanted to do a quick intro for Carol if I could do that.
That would be very good, Amy. Why don't you go ahead and do that right now?
Okay, terrific. So, Carol Dorgan, Carol, I know that you're on the phone. I heard your voice a little earlier.
Yeah.
I just wanted to let everyone know, you can see Carol's bio up on the screen there, but Carol has been working with us. He works out of the Jones Day office in Paris, and he's been working with us since the beginning when we started the implementation process for recommendation number 6. And so Carol's very fully versed, and he's been following the discussion a bit online. And so with that, I just wanted to introduce you all to Carol Dorgan. And Carol, thanks for being here today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
And so I just wanted to let everyone know that what I asked Carol to do is come on the call, give a very short statement and kind of a presentation of what it was, the process that we followed, and how we got to the standards that are now set out in Applicant Guidebook 4, and then to take questions from the group.
Okay. Thank you, Amy, for doing that. Carol, I'll turn it over to you right now.
Okay. Thank you, Chuck. And thank you all for inviting me. I really am quite honored to take part in this and quite interested, too. As Amy said, I have been working on this and following it over the last, 3 years now. I've been invited to make a presentation. I haven't really been given any other terms of reference for the presentation, so I've, based on what I've been hearing you folks say and write and seeing what you've written in the last couple of weeks, I tried to shape what I'm going to say to fit where you are. I'm concerned that I may end up going on too long, so you know, feel free to say it's time to stop and just start discussing or answering questions. The topics that I thought I would address, and then as Amy suggested, kind of lead you through some of the process and the reasoning and what lay behind some of the decisions, would be to focus on the international principles of law in the context of Recommendation 6, and the use of the terms morality and public order, which I know are a hot topic. And if there's time, or as we move on, or even in another call, if you wish, I'd be happy to talk about what you've been calling the outsourcing of the dispute resolution process, the issue of standing for filing objections, the quick look procedure, independent objector, or anything else. But I know those are some of the topics you're also looking at. So turning to international principles of law, Recommendation 6, of course, focuses upon these. And as maybe we could all agree, Recommendation 6 has rather complicated syntax and turns around in circles a little bit. And I'm picking up on something I know was talked about last night. I would definitely agree that the expression that should be used here is principles of international law rather than international principles of law. And that point was made to me by a judge on the International Court of Justice, who said the principles of international law or general principles are certainly a well-established term of art, whereas international principles of law don't really have a particular meaning in the same sense. And if you look at the DAG, the latest version, I think, in paragraph 3.4.3, we do use the term principles of international law, but also there's a problem of consistency, so that could be clarified. Moving on, in Recommendation 6, of course, if you want to implement it or analyze and implement it, you have to take into consideration other important elements of the GNSO report of 3 years ago. And in particular, Principle G, which is, I know, quite familiar to everybody, and also other elements such as the public policy principles that were issued by the GAC, in particular, paragraph 2.1, where they talk about respecting sensitivities regarding terms with national, cultural, geographic, and religious significance. And I think also one has to consider everything, and certainly at the as well, the minority statement on Recommendation 6 that was issued by the NCUC, as well as other materials and comments. So we've looked at all of these things in our research and thinking and drafting and consideration and so forth. So the question then is one could phrase it, or the way we approached this then was, what generally accepted legal norms relating to morality and public order are recognized under principles of international law? And since this is a basis for saying whether or not a string is accepted, in other words, whether or not it's contrary to such norms, the issue is, of course, essentially one of freedom of expression. Or that's an important issue. There are other issues, too, but that's there. And certainly the principles of international law do recognize and protect freedom of expression. And in addition, one must also note that these principles acknowledge certain limits upon that freedom. And you can look, of course, at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Articles 19 and 20, sub 2 in particular, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights in Articles 19 and 20, and then certain regional human rights conventions are very important in this way as well, such as the European Convention on Human Rights with its Article 10 and the American Convention on Human Rights, Article 13. And I'm not going to, obviously don't want to take time reading all this stuff, but I think you can see, and you probably already know, most of you, that all of these instruments do state in one form or another the principle of freedom of expression, and they also make it clear in various terms that there are limits, but that the limitations upon freedom of expression should be construed narrowly you know, in various ways of putting that, a limitation must be necessary in order to protect other important rights and interests. And it's the whole job of judges and others who construe and apply these provisions to decide whether or not a limitation is, in fact, necessary or rather too broad or disproportionate. So the work that we did and led us to the conclusion that you can identify certain general principles of international law in this area, one being that everyone has the right to freedom of expression, another being that the freedom of expression may be subject to certain limits that are necessary to protect other important rights. And I would add that these two principles, in my opinion, are fully consistent with the GNSO principle G, which states that freedom of expression rights should be protected under internationally recognized principles of law. And internationally recognized principles of law recognize freedom of expression and also certain limitations upon that freedom. Now, one could stop here and just come to that conclusion and leave it to experts or ICANN or somebody else to decide case by case, you know, whether or not this is a particular string is entitled to the freedom of expression or whether it falls within the scope of a limitation upon that. However, I think that would leave very broad scope for objections and also would be very unpredictable and likely to be quite subjective and objectionable and unsatisfactory in that respect. And I think in accordance with recommendation 6, one should choose instead, or one can choose instead, to identify certain specific legal norms that are generally accepted. That seems to be the direction in which recommendation 6 takes us. And by identifying certain legal norms such in that way, there would be a narrower, more defined scope for objections. The procedure, the standards, and the results that come out of that procedure in accordance with those standards would be more predictable and more in accordance with, one hopes, with principles of proper balance between freedom of expression and the limits that may be imposed upon that. So that is the sort of the quick review of how one can look at international law and the principles of international law in this context. The question then is, at least I'll jump now to the question, although there may be more to say on that topic, but question then turning to the use of the terms morality and public order, which, of course, from my perspective, looking into this, you know, we inherited from GNSO Recommendation 6. But as you have seen, if you've looked at some of those international instruments that I mentioned and others, they all do, in fact, refer to morality and public order, among other things, as the basis for certain limits upon freedom of expression. One could, and this is, I sort of thought about this some more today after listening to last night's conversation, one could instead refer to public policy or ordre public instead of morality and public order. It's a long public policy or ordre public are well-established, long-established legal concepts. I found a reference to an old House of Lords case from 1853 that gave a definition that people still refer to in English law as ordre public, or public policy is a principle of law that holds that no subject can lawfully do that which has a tendency to be injurious to the public or against public good. It's a term also that's used in modern treaties and laws. And in my own field, you've got my profile up there, for better or worse. I work a lot in international arbitration, and so I'm very conscious of the use of the term public policy, which is the basis, can be the basis for refusing enforcement of a foreign arbitral award under the New York Convention. And it's also the basis for refusing enforcement and also overturning awards under the UNCITRAL model law on commercial arbitration, which has been adopted in, I think, some 50 states around the world. So public policy has some meaning, public policy and ordre public that sometimes considered to be, you know, translations of other, each other, but in other contexts they're different. So, and they may indeed include morality or morals when you try to give meaning to this. So it's not a rock hard, you know, clear, bright line sort of concept, but it does have, I think, some real meaning in law. And I would say also that it's public policy is fuzzy around the edges, it's still more precise and grounded in legal concepts than the concept of the phrase public interest, which is much, I think, much more imprecise in general. Turning back to some of the work we were doing, and I won't go through the details here, a lot of it is described in the explanatory memoranda that ICANN has published and you've read, but examining these principles of international law in the case law of certain tribunals that operate under the treaties I mentioned. For example, the European Court of Human Rights has an abundant case law under Article 10, and there are also cases decided under the American Convention on Human Rights and within the Human Rights Commission of the operating under the Covenant of Civil and Political Rights. We also had the opportunity to consult with judges who are presently sitting or former judges on certain international tribunals, such as the International Court of Justice and the Inter-American Court of Human Rights and the Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, you know, various judges who are really quite established and well experienced in human rights law in particular. And we also consulted local lawyers to learn about public policy limits upon freedom of expression under national laws. And the conclusions from this research and these consultations enabled us, I think, to identify certain categories of expression that are limited in one way or another in virtually all jurisdictions. And so they are, in that sense, legal norms that are generally accepted in the world. And those are, as you're very familiar, I think, the incitement, the ones we identified as the incitement to a promotion of violent, lawless action, incitement or promotion of discrimination based on race, color, gender, ethnicity, religion, or national origin, and incitement or promotion of child pornography or other sexual abuse of children. And so that was the result then was where the dispute resolution standards for morality and public order objections that were presented in the draft applicant guidebook in section 3.4.3. But in addition to the three specific grounds that I've just mentioned, there's a fourth category that you're aware of, which is more general, which is to allow scope for the exercise of discretion within the framework of Recommendation 6 and or within the same sort of class of category of legal norms as that are specifically identified there. But I think a lot of people we talk with and are in our own thinking, ICANN's thinking, there's a feeling that you can't just have an exclusive list of categories that there's needs to be some broader scope than that. And I think maybe the whole thing that has produced this working group, namely the objections or the comments from the GAC, show that fourth category is really where one needs to maybe be thinking and focusing attention. So the current issue, as I understand it, is whether or not, or as I would say this is the current issue, is whether or not these standards that are identified in the DAG are appropriate or are sufficient. And I know that some people criticize the standards or maybe the whole process, but these standards in particular, from the point of view that ICANN should not bar any string on any morality, public order, or public policy basis outside its scope of activities. There's another perspective, and I think the GAC's criticism, as I understand it, comes from another direction, and that is that these standards are insufficient to block some strings that, while falling short of the incitement standards that are identified specifically, nonetheless offend certain sensitivities. And so, as I see it, that's really the heart of your terms of reference or your task. One thing I would mention in this context is that to stress that governments do have the right under the current version of the DAG and so forth. Governments do have the right to file objections under Recommendation 6 procedure. There's never not any question that they would not have that right. So there's no question of them not having the right to bring their views and concerns forward. The question is, I guess, twofold. One is, are governments willing to play that game? Are they willing to go into the dispute procedure, filing objections and then the dispute procedure? And I think there may be some questions about that. And the second issue is, are the governments satisfied with the standards that are set out there? Or do they feel that, certain important sensitivities, using that term again, will not be admitted or not be accepted as the grounds for an objection under the current procedure and standards? One could ask, what standards would a panel or ICANN eventually apply in deciding whether to accept or reject an objection from a single government, for example, regarding a string that offends its so-called sensitivities or, its national law. And we know that could be quite a wide range of sensitivities if you look around the world and kinds of rejections that could be made. I think I'll probably should conclude soon, pose a few more, examples of the kind of problematic cases once you move away from some of those more narrowly defined categories. There's a big debate, or a big issue over, say, the distinction between incitement to violent lawless action and what might be called mere hate speech. And in some places, with a very strong tradition of protecting freedom of expression, there are still statutes, criminal laws against hate speech. Whereas in other jurisdictions, other places, hate speech is protected speech, and only incitement to violent lawless action, which satisfies certain criteria, would be considered unacceptable and barred. There are other kinds of examples of problematic cases. You can imagine, Holocaust denial would be illegal in where I'm sitting right now, for example, in France, but it would not be illegal elsewhere. Would that be one of the sensitivities that should be brought within the standards of Recommendation 6 or not? And there may be, I think it's inappropriate, not part of the etiquette around here, to give too many specific examples, but you can imagine a group that is considered by one government to be subversive, terrorist, or whatever, applying for a string that would otherwise pass muster. So those are the issues that are before you. I hope that leading through our sort of our quick review of our research and our thinking and analysis. Helps to focus on the issues on those points or helps you in any way in the discussion. As I said, I could also go on and talk about other topics, but maybe it would be best now for me to shut up and let you ask questions or discuss or whatever else.
Thank you very much, Carol. I appreciate that very much. For those of you who have questions, any types of question, clarification or other types of questions. I ask you to be concise because I suspect there will be lots of them. And while people are raising their hands, Carol, could you talk just a little bit about the term incitement? There have been, as you've probably seen, some concerns about the use of that term in the first three categories in the applicant guidebook.
Mm-hmm. Right. I've seen some of those concerns, and I think some of them are coming from the perspective of the criminal law, where incitement to do something, certain kinds of incitement, are a crime. I mean, there's incitement to direct and public incitement to commit genocide is a crime under international law. It's established directly under the Genocide Convention. It has been picked up in the statutes of the criminal courts, criminal tribunals for former Yugoslavia and Rwanda. There's an important case law on the subject, and so you can tackle it from that direction. And the problem in there, of course, normally a crime such as that requires both some action as well as intent. And so people are saying, well, you know, how does that fit within the GTLD string? One answer to that is that, well, we're not talking about criminalizing anything. We're talking about whether or not the applicant who presents this string should get it. And so, you know, it's a different analysis, perhaps. The question of proving intent, which is very important in criminal law, of incitement for something, is not necessarily the same or even necessary here. You know, it could be, as others I know have pointed out and discussed, there's a question of context. In the context of as we read this, would that constitute a kind of incitement or promotion? I mean, you know, the terms are used in two ways. It's a little bit of maybe a discussion of whether or not the two words, how much they overlap and so forth. There is a distinction, and incitement is a more precise legal term, I think. But I think that you have to make sure that you're not just looking at this only in the strict criminal law terms of the elements required to establish the offense, which is the what is required in criminal law, but it's more, do we see this as promoting, encouraging, leading to this problem, you know, whether it's violence or child pornography or whatever. Is that helpful?
I think so, but let me do this. To try and keep us, at least for a few minutes, on specific strings, let's see if anybody has any questions regarding the use of the term incitement, because there's been quite a bit of list discussion regarding that term. And so, Mary, did you want to talk about the term incitement?
Actually, Chuck, no, I didn't, so I can hold my question
for you. Okay, thanks. You just stay in queue. Keep your hand up. You don't need to take your hand down. Is there anyone who has a question regarding the use of the term incitement in the first three categories? Olivier?
No, Chuck. I didn't. I was going to make a comment, so I'll stay in queue and remain quiet for the time being.
Okay. Very, very good. Bertrand?
Yes, good evening. This is just a question because on the list there was a very interesting question that basically asks whether a term in itself can be considered an incitement. Like just having the string itself, can it be considered as an incitement, or is there a need for something more proactive or content attached to it and so on? This is a very delicate topic that was raised on the list, and I don't have a precise answer.
Thank you, Bertrand. Carol, can you respond to that?
Well, I can. I mean, I'm not going to have sort of, you know, an answer that puts this issue to rest, but first of all, I would say I think that the answer is yes in some circumstances. In this context, it may be worth remembering that strings can run up to 63 characters, so you can put practically a speech into one of those, and it can certainly have a subject, a verb, and an object, and more than one. And so the expression of a strong idea like that can be pretty well encapsulated in a string. I was reading in preparation for this call parts of some of the judgments that were rendered in what's called the media trial in Rwanda, where the people responsible for what was called Radio Mille Collines, which was a Hutu extremist radio, and which it was very had a great responsibility in promoting and inciting the genocide in Rwanda in 1994, and the courts, there's a trial chamber and then an appeals chamber, grappled a lot with what constituted incitement, and they focused of course, these were radio broadcasts, which were more than just a string, but they also were focusing on the specific terms that were being used. And, there were certain terms that were, that had become, like kill the cockroaches was one of the, expressions that was used and was understood in context, obviously, as an encouragement and incitement to go out and murder Tutsis. And there were people who were convicted of under the statute of the tribunal of direct and public incitement to genocide, to commit genocide. So I think words do, can be an incitement, and there can be a lot of them in a string, and there also is a question of context, and it would be, I think, open to a expert panel or ICANN to decide that, under the circumstances, this is an incitement to violent, lawless action, and conclude that it therefore should not enter the route. And I was thinking of some other examples. I mean, imagine, some slogan from the Nazi era, and which conveys a certain meaning and has been well established, and it raises the question, are we in the hate speech region of hate speech, or are we in the area of direct incitement? And that's a reasonable issue, but there's certainly a case could be made that it was incitement.
Okay, thank you.
Take a break.
Cheryl, did you want to talk about incitement?
No, my hand's up as a placeholder for Evan.
Oh, okay.
Hi, Chuck.
Evan,
yeah.
Would you like to talk about? Go ahead.
I just wanted to ask about the issue of, to what extent is incitement in the eye of the beholder? So, for instance, could something like Free Tibet, that is absolutely benign in the eyes of an awful lot of people, in the eyes of some, could that not be seen as code word for something that they would consider to be lawless action? And where do you draw the line between something that may seem obvious and something that isn't obvious but can and often is, in general sense, perceived to be code for something that incites? The problem I've had with this whole thing is where you draw the line and the arbitrariness of what determines what is inciting.
Would you like to respond to that?
I mean, my feeling is that an expert panel would find it no trouble in dismissing an objection to Free Tibet. I mean, it's simply because somebody might read into that some other some objections. It's we're getting into the problem of sensitivities of certain governments, perhaps. I mean, I suppose you could say also that, kill the cockroaches, to take that example, which is right out of a case, sort of an awful, I hate saying it, but I mean, this is this big issue in one of these cases. You could imagine some company that sells, insecticide, is might be promoting that, you do have an issue of context, but I think, one could decide that that was a, that was over the line. The one I was thinking about from the Nazi period is an interesting issue, hypothetical. Julius Streicher was the publisher of the Der Schirmer, which is the most notorious Jew-baiting, pornographic Nazi newspaper, and he was tried and eventually convicted and hanged for what amounted to incitement to commit genocide. He himself not committed, but he was tried in Nuremberg and convicted of that, of it being an accomplice. And the banner, the standard banner, which is the slogan, which epitomized the Nazi message and his message, was "Die Juden sind unser Unglück." The Jews are our misfortune. I mean, imagine a string that had that as that's the string, or you could add the word "noch" at the end. They're still, and would that be an incitement to some violent, lawless action? I think that you can see that as being more likely to be over the line than Free Tibet. So, but it's definitely an area where you have judges making determinations, and not everyone agrees upon every decision. But that doesn't mean that you can't sort of articulate a certain standard and then try to find good, thoughtful, reasonable jurists who will then decide on them.
Yeah, I think that, I think the main issue is that it's getting into context, which is a whole different thing we need to swing into later.
Well, we might swing into that sooner rather than later. But first, let me give a specific example that was mentioned in the chat. Do you think that a panel of experts would find, I know you're just venturing an opinion, but a string, kill Hindus, would be considered incitement?
I think so. I think strings that say kill anybody is likely to be considered unacceptable. That's my personal feeling that could be treated as incitement. Yes.
Thank you. Now, I think Evan is right. You mentioned context, and I was thinking the same thing as you were talking about context. As you are well aware, ICANN doesn't have, as part of its mission, any governance over content of websites, et cetera, but rather coordination of identifiers like domain name. How does context come into play without getting into content? And how a domain name used? Is it possible to consider context without exceeding ICANN's mission?
I think they should try. I think so. The point has come up, for example, in context of the issue of say incitement or promotion of child pornography and so forth. And the position ICANN has taken and the approach they've taken here is that when we consider this standard and this context with objections, we're looking at the string and not the content. And, of course, the content is a whole separate issue. And, of course, we know that there can be criminal sort of abuse of children and pornography and so forth within a site that has a perfectly benign sort of name. And that's a separate issue, and there are separate, you know, remedies against that and so forth. So we're trying to focus here on the string and decide whether or not there is any aspect of the string itself which is objectionable. And if there are other problems that arise from the content, that would have to be dealt with separately, I think.
Okay, thank you. I don't want to keep Mary and Olivier waiting any longer. So Mary, why don't you go ahead?
Thanks, Chuck. And this is somewhat related in terms of what the answer might be. Carol, thanks for the presentation. And my question was, even if we're talking about principles of international law and the findings of an expert panel, one of my difficulties is that when we're talking about that, you're really talking about whether a nation state does or does not fulfill its obligations, say, under an international treaty, and there's established dispute mechanisms and frameworks for that with particular consequences. How does that translate to a scheme basically of private ordering, where we're talking about private applicants and ICANN as a not-for-profit corporation, particularly given that the decision of the panel would appear to be something that the ICANN board would accept, and currently there's no appeal mechanism? Thanks.
I'm not sure I have that whole question fully within my grasp. But, I mean, first of all, I think, as I understand it, the board will remain free to accept or not a determination by the panel. But the panel's determination is important for the board and important to that they normally would take into account. Then, apart from that, the heart of your question, if I understand it, is how do we transfer or translate or adapt public law issues to a private law context?
And I
think the answer is in a way, maybe it's too simple, but I think it's powerful enough, and that is that here's a private actor, ICANN, trying to decide what it will do, what kind of standards it will apply to certain issues. And it, you know, it's free. They're free to adapt whatever standards they find useful and appropriate. And just as you know, private parties do quite often choose in their contracts to adopt as the applicable law general principles of law. If one of my clients were to propose that in their contract, I would say, well, that alone is going to perhaps might not be a good choice because then it'll be costly and difficult to identify what those general principles of law are. But they can do it, you know, and they can adopt a certain standard if they wish. And so I can say, well, we see and since we are we're not just any old private actor, we are, you know, an entity that's active around the world with global, you know, activities and interests and you know, stakeholders and all the rest. It's appropriate for us to look to international law standards, and they do exist, and sort of domesticate them. So they are in fact taking public law standards and translating them to or adapting them in a private law context.
Mary, did that answer your question?
Yes, it does. I may have some follow-ups later, but thank you again, Carol.
You're welcome. I mean, it may have answered, but it may not be satisfactory. I don't know, but that's the way I see it.
Thanks. Okay, Olivier.
Thank you, Chuck. So far, I'm pretty happy with what I've heard from Carol, but I do have one question which keeps on bugging me, and it's the one where if ICANN doesn't base its decisions on international law and effectively bases them on the objections made by specific countries, does ICANN take then the responsibility of blocking, if it does take the responsibility of blocking a top-level domain application, does it open itself potentially to litigation?
I don't see how they would be doing that. They may be opening themselves more to litigation if they allow it into the root. But I don't see that should prosper either. I don't think that ICANN is I think it, as you said rather than adopting international law, they are adopting a national law. I mean, that's not really what they would be doing under the current scheme of things. Instead, they are looking to legal norms that are widely accepted around the world. In fact, we looked at, I think, what was it, someone counted recently, 8 jurisdictions. I mean, that's not a heck of a lot, in the grand scheme of things, but it was a diverse group of countries, cultures, different geographic regions, but also countries with you know, more or less the rule of law that applied, and I'm sure we could have doubled or tripled that number and come up with similar results. So it's not really a question of applying a national law. And I would also add that international tribunals look to municipal laws and national laws in certain contexts to give meaning to the general principles of law. The general principle of law is a term that you can one place you'll find it, in a very important place, is in the statute of the International Court of Justice in Article 38, which defines the sources of international law as applied by the International Court of Justice, and one of those sources is the general principles of law as applied by civilized nations, as they put it in those days. And when the court turns to general principles of law, they may well look at the more detailed rules of national law, but they won't just sort of adapt one national law. They look for a certain practice and a certain consensus, depending on issues. It's often in procedural matters, not so much as much substance. But so that's, I think, what we're doing here with the process that led to the identification of those three standards.
But the problem that you're faced with, Chuck, can I respond to that?
Yes, you may. Go ahead.
Thank you. The problem, though, is that you're dealing specifically, and I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, you're dealing with commercial issues. but one deals here with potentially political issues which have a much further reaching hand than just commercial issues of being right or wrong on the commercial space.
When you say I'm dealing with commercial issues, in what context? You mean
In the context of the decisions being made here, some decisions will be highly political, and some of the some of the objections that will be filed by some countries will be only politically motivated. And the concern I have is that ICANN gets drawn in these political fights, international geopolitical fights that are taking place, and by making a decision itself. I just wonder whether there is a danger of that.
I suppose there's a danger of that. I mean, that's partly Well, let's put it this way. You know, if you look at the standards that have been identified or set out by ICANN in the draft applicant guidebook, they are, focused upon certain types of expression that, where there's a large consensus, they should be barred. Now, if you broaden the standards to say that, any person, or say any government or whatever, can bring any objection forward saying this string would violate our national law here in wherever we are, or it will really offend the sensitivities of the particular group that lives out there in the southwest of our country, or whatever. That will certainly invite greater politicization of the process than what we have set out here.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, sure. Cheryl.
Thank you, Chuck. But in fact, this is a hand for Evan again. Go ahead, Evan.
Hi, Chuck. And in fact, I'm taking off my personal hat now and speaking as the chair of the GTLD working group within ALAC, which has been over the issue of context many, many times and really has come to the opinion that this is a extreme hornet's nest. Not only that, but many of the kind of contexts that we're discussing and that may come up could be addressed through the existing community objection process. If somebody proposes a string, kill the blah, whatever blah is, likely whatever community of blah is going to be able to have a community objection that this particular string is inappropriate in reference to its community. That objection process already exists. It's not part of the existing morality and public order regime and can tackle a lot of the more odious versions of this without sucking ICANN into the pit of having to deal with context. And so I guess my own issue here is I'm hoping to narrow the focus rather than to broaden it. And I really hope that there's a consideration for the fact that the community process of objections that's already been very well thought through and very, I think, effective, has the ability to deal with a lot of them without having to bring them into this particular corner of the objection process.
Thank you, Evan.
Can I respond to that?
Just for the record, that is an ALAC view.
Thank you, Cheryl. And go ahead, Carol.
Yes, well, first of all, as things are set up now, and of course one could add that they can always be changed, but as things are set up right now, one can only file a community objection to a community application. And so there are certain requirements for applications for a community GTLD. It's a certain category of GTLDs that ICANN has set up, and it is only somebody from a defined community with standing that can file an objection against a community GTLD. So a person or a group or whatever entity that applies for a general GTLD, which is not a community GTLD, would not be subject to a community objection at all. You could change that, but that's the way it is right now. And to say that anybody can file what they call a community objection against any GTLD would have some repercussions probably in the whole system.
Well, for instance, the context that we were talking about is not only, you know, for instance, .Nazi being run by the Wiesenthal Center, but also the reverse. A benign string like .Jew being applied for by Hamas is the one that was bandied around before. So the problem is not just, you know, then you get far afield from the issue of strings that on their own could be objectionable and get into benign strings that could have very nasty effect. If you get into context, isn't that opening up just a whole barrel of problem?
It probably is. I mean, okay, Hamas applies for .Jew. They're not applying for it as a community GTLD because they wouldn't satisfy the requirements for that. So they've just jumped in. Could you then object? I mean, a person, it's not going to satisfy the requirements of the morality and public order objection as now defined. You can then broaden the standards and say that, you know, a group that feels that it's that they are entitled to this string or that it's a great offense against their own interests or rights and safety or whatever. That could be then added to the standards, but it does, of course, open up quite a broad range of standards. And you're not, whether you have these objections that come through a modified version of the community system or through morality and public order with another name, if you wish, one way or another, there's a dispute that's going to have to be resolved through some sort of process, and whether it's the objection process that you have now or going straight to the board or some other. You're not going to get away from that. What you've described, unless you just say that there's got going to be some sort of wide-ranging veto over applications, I guess. But otherwise, it is possible. You certainly have the prospect of objectionable strings being applied for.
Now, let me try and get to some clarity on the direction we're going right now. What I'm thinking right now, and I may be wrong, is that this area that we're exploring now actually provides, I think, in my view, some legitimacy to the GAC's concern, in the sense that there may not be a way to dispute strings like Carol just illustrated. For example, Hamas applying for .Jew. If they did that as a general TLD, am I correct that there aren't grounds right now in the dispute processes for dealing with that?
I don't think there are. I think on the other hand, a Jewish group could apply for .Jew as a community GTLD, and they would likely get it. So Hamas would not. So, but that depends, of course, upon their being that group. And of course, another thing that can happen is that, you know, there are different religious communities under the same rubric. There might be a Jewish group in New York that applies for it, another one in, you know, Orthodox and conservative and or Reformed and all that. And they may themselves have quite a dispute over who's entitled to .Jew, but there's a procedure for that. You know, there's a way of resolving those kinds of disputes and within the system that ICON is proposing to set up. So that would, you know, assuming that someone else is going to apply for that string, then that would resolve it. But of course, Hamas can always think of something else that if they want to, or some other group can think of something else that would raise the issue. It's for things like this that, you know, you probably do want to have some discretion and flexibility in the system. I have the feeling that if I can just give my own personal view here, and I'm not speaking for ICON right now, I have to say, because we haven't discussed this, I don't have any instructions from them. But my feeling is that a useful approach for resolving the issues that GAC has raised is to work on that fourth criterion under the what's now called the morality and public order objection, and the name overall could be changed too. But maybe that could be formulated in a way that would give some comfort to the GAC and others who feel that their concerns are not satisfied under the three very rather strictly defined categories, other criteria before that.
Thank you, Carol. Bertrand, you're next.
Yeah, thank you, and thanks to Ivan to have raised the notion of community objection, because the more I listen to the discussion online and now in the call, I would like to remind people, and I have to go back to the DAG myself, the community objection actually provides a very interesting framework because, as you know, there are four criteria that the community objector must fulfill. First of all, it needs to be a proven community. And there's an ambiguity because the text says a portion of the community to which the string may be targeted. So it seems to apply for a community string that wants to serve a community, but it doesn't apply in this formulation to a string that would target in the wrong way a community. But the objector must be a representative of the community. There must be substantial opposition. But the third element is targeting a strong association between the applied for GTLD string and the community represented. And there are many aspects that can be statements contained in the application, public statements by the applicant, associations by the public, which gives and covers in part the notion of context. But the most important one is a notion of detriment. And it says the objector must prove that there is a likelihood of detriment to the rights or legitimate interests of its associated communities. And there's a list of factors like damage to the reputation, not acting in accordance with the interests of the community, and so on. And so, as a matter of fact, I think the comments that we've been making on the list are right. This is probably enough to cover any of the dot kill the whatever that we've been discussing. So I think in the discussion in the group, we should explore a little bit further how and whether the community objection can be leveraged for the things that are not universally objectionable. So I think it's very useful as far as I'm concerned.
But I think it's very important that we're all on the same page with regard to when a community-based application applies. And I think Carol said this, is that a community-based dispute can only be filed against a community-based GTLD. Keep in mind that there is nothing that prevents someone from applying for a TLD that might on its surface be oriented towards the community, but they elect to go the general route instead of the community-based route. And in that case, if I'm understanding it correctly, then the community-based dispute doesn't apply, can't be used. Is everybody – can I say that right?
Can you jump to Kurt, please?
Sure.
Sorry, Chuck, Kurt has an important intervention here.
Thank you, Cheryl. Yes, Kurt.
Hey, Cheryl. Hey, Chuck. How are you guys doing? Thank you. I typed it in, and first of all, this is my first chance to thank Carol for all the hard work that went into this and all the questions he's had to answer from a group that is used to firing questions at people. So, Carol, please accept my thanks. And, I just want to add the clarification that a community-based objection does not have to be can be launched at any TLD application, not just community-based application.
Yep.
And the thought behind that is to prevent a misappropriation of the community label. And so, you know, that's clear in the guidebook and, you know, might modify the discussion we're having here.
Thank you very much, Kurt. That's critical. Appreciate it.
I apologize for getting it wrong there, Susan. I thought I was misinformed myself.
No problem. And Chuck, I've asked Kurt to pin something, copy to each of us and the list, so we can make sure it goes back to our ACs and, of course, you to the GNSO, but also that we're all working on the same fact-based page.
And so, Bertrand, then I think that your comments fit right in then. So, and we do have an avenue there. Thank you for that, and thanks, Kurt, for the clarification. Did you have anything else to say on that, Kurt?
No, thanks, unless there's questions.
Yeah, okay, thanks a lot. Richard, you're next.
Yeah, hey, it's Richard. Yeah, just to add to what Kurt said there as well, the objecting party doesn't themselves have to have applied for, you know, that string or, in fact, any string at all in order to be able to object.
Right, and I assume, though, that if their objection is based on the interests of a community, they would have to meet the four criterion that Bertrand mentioned. Is that correct, Kurt?
That's correct.
I didn't get that, Kurt.
So that's correct. There are standing requirements.
It is correct. Okay. Thank you. We have another. Richard?
Yeah, again, just to add a little bit, it is, of course, correct. Yeah, the objecting party has to meet the sort of the same standard. But as Bertrand said a minute ago, the objecting party has to go even a little bit further, and that is prove that there would be detriment resulting from the other party having the TLD.
Right. Thank you, Richard. Any other questions or comments for Carol?
Bertrand?
Chuck?
Yes, go ahead, Bertrand.
Yeah, just a precision on what Richard was saying. It is not so much to prevent somebody else from using the TLD and getting it for the objection, the person who makes the objection. De facto, you can have somebody making, if I understand correctly, you can have an actor doing a community-based objection just to prevent that specific TLD for being given at all. And he will not apply. I mean, I cannot imagine the Hindus applying for Dot Kill Hindus, for instance. But I think in that case, the community objection is fully applicable to Dot Kill Hindus.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Alan?
I don't have a question on my own behalf, but we got into this whole discussion largely driven by statements from the GAC, or at least from GAC members, that the existing words in the morality and public order objection process were not implemented. That is, there were not sufficient international laws and established principles, and therefore it was not something that was likely to be workable. And I guess I would like to hear something back from the GAC members who are on this group. Is there something new that's come out in this discussion, or do they believe that they or other GAC members still feel, despite what Carol has said, that it's not something that can be actually implemented?
Yeah, and Mark's in the queue. I don't know if Mark wants to respond to that, but I'll find out first. Mark?
Thanks, Chuck, and thanks, Carol, for a very useful survey of the issues that you've covered. I have learned a good point about the possibility of incitement being captured within a string. I think that's a very important point for us to note. I wasn't sure about that, and I think it's valuable for us in the GAC to take account of that. My question was related to that, really, because we have talked about incitement. There is this word promotion of activities or interests which create sensitivities. My question to Carol was whether there is any useful steer from him or from practice or legal practice internationally or at national level with regard to promotion, the intention of a string not to get people to do something, but to promote a stand on something which is going to be to the detriment of the interests of communities or nation states or so on, and so on. Is there some guidance it can provide us with regard to that. And I'm assuming there is a distinction here, which I've tried to sort of capture in a rather crude way, maybe, between what promotion is and what incitement is. So that was my question with regard to that. My overall sense is I'm getting a feeling that there is valuable inference coming from international law here, which I had. I'm not a lawyer, so I don't. This is all territory that I'm not familiar with. But I'm getting a valuable inferences coming from this discussion about the relevance of international public law. Thanks.
I don't have a good answer to take off the shelf. I mean, I think you raised a good point, and to some extent, using those two words instead of just one of them kind of gives an idea of a broader rule than saying simply incitement. I think my understanding, I don't have some case law to support this with off the top of my head, but my understanding of promotion is being a broader, less precise term. You do see promotion in various legal texts. One that I happen to have in front of me is elements of the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, which has a very broad set of standards for limiting speech, much broader than some of the others and not accepted, I think, in a lot of places, which condemns all propaganda. This is Article 4, and organizations that are based on ideas of racial superiority and so forth. It shall, in 4B, 4A, declares an offense punishable by law all dissemination of ideas based on racial superiority or hatred. So hate speech would be, simply criminalized here. But they also, and they do mention in sub B there, declares illegal and prohibits organizations and so forth which promote and incite racial discrimination. I mean, so promotion would perhaps be one that simply favors it as opposed to inciting, which is supposed to produce action, in response. I think that may be the distinction. There's a greater focus upon the action that follows incitement. And that's sometimes the distinction I see between incitement and what's sometimes to distinguish it called mere hate speech, which is not in some contexts or in some systems criminalized. I don't think that's a full and satisfactory answer for you, but it's something with one could work on some more if you like.
Does that help, Mark?
Yeah, thanks very much. I think that's. That is a helpful introduction to that distinction between the two. I mean, coming from a government perspective, reference was made earlier on to geopolitical issues and the fear of ICANN and individual GAC members being caught up in geopolitical disputes over territory and promotion of sovereignty and so on strikes me as one example of where a difficulty would arise from a string which is advocating a sovereignty claim, whether it's Falkland.
Yeah.
Stroke Malvina, whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, my UK is caught up in a lot of these through various historical legacies that survive into our current political environment. I guess that's what I wanted to say on that, really. So I think it's worth thinking about further, certainly. And I take I also appreciate this steer to the fourth bullet in the DAG 4 on morality and public order. We need to look at that a lot more, I think.
Yes, I think right there. Go ahead.
I was going to say just some of the community issues that we're just discussing could fit there maybe just as well. And of course, it's not only communities that. They'll have the sensitivities or other kinds of issues. But as we said, that might be a useful thing to look at.
Okay. Now, Alan asked a question of any GAC members that might be able to respond. Alan, could you just very quickly restate your question?
It was just that a lot of the discussion that started the MAPO discussion was that the current wording was not really implementable, that there were no such international principles, and there is no mechanism of doing what the applicant guidebook says. And my question was, is there any indication that based on this discussion, those governments may have been wrong and indeed it is implementable, or is that position stand? Again, I'm not asking for formal answers from governments here, but I'm just, is there any belief that there was sufficient misunderstanding that has been clarified now, or is that position still stands? Again, I'm not advocating one or the other. I'd just like to really understand.
Is your office over there?
Yeah, just for a meeting.
Perhaps that needs to be a question on a question we've noticed.
Yes, that's essentially what I was trying to do, and thank you for the better words.
Okay.
Frank, we might take that on notice and see what might trickle back.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay.
Certainly we'll take that up. I mean, the GAC concern was that there was no firm definition as it was put forward, and that governments were entitled to take reservations from existing, from treaty positions on that ground. That was the point. That it was governments could reserve positions on the grounds of morality and public order, and that there were no established principles in treaty text about what that meant. It was for individual national interpretation. Now, if Carol's position is that that's not the case, then that is new information for me, certainly, and we'd need to investigate that and go back and take another look at it. But Carol, perhaps you could assist us by actually dealing with that point particularly. What the information that we have is that that the term morality and public order is one which is used for national governments within their own jurisdictions to take reservations from treaty text. So in other words, it's a sort of a negative exception condition rather than a positive international standard. Thank you.
Well, yeah, I saw that, and I really have to tell you, I thought that the people making that point at the GAC were really missing some important aspects of international law and the international instruments that, you know, address this topic. We're not only talking about the Paris Treaty with patents and whether or not a state can decline to enforce a patent on grounds of its morality and public order rules, but in fact we have in instruments such as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which state, on the one hand, everyone has the right to freedom of expression, and then they go on to say, but these rights may be subject to certain restrictions, which are based upon morality and public order, or other reasons as well. And so it's stating two aspects of one, the full dimensions of this freedom. It's not sort of saying we're out here, some international instrument saying there's freedom of expression, and then you can derogate from that freedom. I think the content itself is saying, freedom of expression is a right which is important, has a tremendous amount of importance, and but it is not absolute. So freedom of expression, as it is defined in international instruments such as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the others, as it is defined with certain qualifications, and those qualifications are expressed in different ways. But you see the terms or the notion of public order and morals come up, and then as everyone has seen, you know, many of these the content of ordre public, public order, and so forth, may be defined nationally, but the they can also be judged against international standards, which is what the European Court of Human Rights does in many, many cases. They're looking at an international standard of the scope of freedom of expression in accordance with Article 10 of the European Convention, which also refers to prevention of disorder and protection of health or morals.
Is that helpful?
Yeah. It's Frank here again. I think I am going to follow this up and seek further clarification from and because with all due absolute due respect, Carolyn, and like Mark, I am not a lawyer, and I'm certainly no knowledge at all of international law and precedent. But this is a very different point of view from the one that I've been informed of. So I'd like to follow up and see if, in fact, this is a debatable point or not.
I don't have any authority, of course, to volunteer ICANN resources and so forth, but I'm going to throw this out and let ICANN staff deal with it however they feel appropriate. Could there be some value in a consultation with interested GAC members and Carol and ICANN staff on this to make sure there's a common understanding here? I'll leave that, Kurt, with your team in terms of whether you want to follow up on that or not, and with the GAC leadership in terms of whether they would like to follow up. But I appreciate the discussion in this regard. Are there any other questions or comments for Carol before we run out of time? While people are thinking, good points have been made again on Category 4. The one that we've been spending a lot of time on the list, with regard to terminology, and I see Bertrand's hand up, but a question I was going to throw out, Carol, is, okay, you've seen the discussion of calling that category, just titling it, public interest objections. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, I do. As I briefly mentioned at the beginning of this chat, I think that public interest is quite a broad and maybe perhaps a nebulous concept in this context, and certainly it could just mean any executive of any government saying we care about this. I think public policy has a little bit more meaning and is probably consistent with what you are trying all of you are trying to do. So if you were going to suggest a change, I think it would be a better idea to propose public policy, maybe parentheses ordre public, because the two are sometimes linked, and it's in many countries, not just Francophone countries, they use the term ordre public as more or less equivalent, and that would perhaps be that would be my recommendation anyway, rather than public interest.
Thank you, Bertrand.
I certainly would be very happy if a French word, an expression, were to get into that. But that aside, I just wanted to highlight something that Carol alluded to. In the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the exceptions to various liberties and freedoms have very specific requirements. They have to be adopted by law, and this means at the national level, by law, to ensure the fulfillment of the freedoms of others. And there's a general principle of proportionality. I think that, and I've mentioned that earlier, that in the general scheme of things, there is a parallel principle that we have not discussed really, but that is a general agreement that if a TLD is accepted by ICANN, in principle, it should not be blocked unless there are very specific exceptions at the national level, i.e. it is being done by law with the motivation and an explicit formulation of the reasons why the TLD is being blocked completely. The notion of granularity that I've mentioned in previous posts means, and proportionality means, that in the same way that we try to prevent the blocking of a whole content hosting site like YouTube and accept more easily, if ever, the notion that a specific content, according to national law and due process with court appeals, is put in place, means that at the global level, it should more or less be the same. In general, hopefully, a TLD should not be blocked in its entirety, and hopefully the process we have here would mean that the TLD itself would be would have passed a certain number of possible objections. And so the notion of morality and public order could potentially come, if we want to do that, as a case where national governments, as an exception to the notion that a TLD is not being blocked, could be doing it, provided that it is done through appropriate legal means for very specific purposes or for specific reasons of morality and public order. So I think that the expression morality and public order is probably the only place where it fits appropriately as an exception to the general principle, yet unformulated, that as a matter of principle, TLD as a whole should not be blocked if it has been entered into the root.
Thank you, Bertrand. Any other questions or comments? Okay, not seeing any hands or hearing anyone. Thank you very, very much, Carol, for taking the time with us here today. We very much appreciate that. And thank you to Margie and Amy and any others who were involved in arranging this today. I think it was very helpful, as several people have expressed, so that's much appreciated.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it. And if you want to invite me again, I'm happy to participate again.
Carol, thanks so much. This is Amy. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Okay, well, thanks a lot. Now, just to wrap up our meeting, and we're just about out of time, a doodle poll has been put out for possible meeting times, few possible times on Wednesday and Thursday, and one on Friday, I think. Please respond to that. We have a report that we have to deliver on Monday, regardless of whether we have consensus recommendations or not, so that the board has some information. So Margie is trying by the end of the day today to put around a skeleton report that has some basic information, not specific recommendations, so that we can at least have a framework to build upon as we do reach any agreements this week. My thinking is, and Cheryl and Frank, please tell me if you think I'm off base on this, and others as well, that we should have our regular call, the call we've been having on Monday, but that it would be very helpful if we could have a couple more calls this week if there are enough parties that can make it. For those who have responded, I think there are so far quite a few that can make a two or three at a time. So if we're going to have a call tomorrow, Glenn will have to get the information out that right away. So if you haven't responded to that doodle poll, please do so. And if anyone wants to share a comment with regard to my suggestion that we try to have a couple more meetings this week and then the one on Monday, please comment right now before I adjourn the call. And let's continue the discussion on the list. And let's focus on, you know, maybe we, with the information we have today, I think we got some good information with regard to the term incitement. We got some, you know, from several directions, I think we see the need to work on Category 4, which we were already working on, so let's continue the work on that and see if we can get closer to something that we can all live with. And several people have made some good suggestions in that regard. So any questions or comments before I adjourn? Okay, thank you, everybody, for your participation. And hopefully we'll talk again before this week's out, maybe twice. So have a good rest of the day.